Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 2nd, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Can you believe it's November? Mm-hmm. And it just feels like we just had Christmas.
Exactly.
So, D.R., there was a... I think I heard it described as a headline-grabbing report recently from the World Health Organization, which someone called WHO, which I don't think they actually call it WHO. They call it the WHO, World Health Organization. They came out, and they said something that will horrify every barbecuer and steak fan in the United States, said that processed meats, that is to say bologna, ham, bacon, that stuff, is in the same category as cigarette smoking for causing cancer, right? It's a known carcinogen.
Yep.
And that red meat is probably a carcinogen, right? Mm-hmm. Did you see that?
Exactly. Brings new meaning to the phrase "meat is murder." The New York Times noted that the World Health Organization concluded Monday that eating processed meat like hot dogs, ham, and bacon raises the risk of colon cancer, and that consuming other red meats probably raises the risk as well. And this caused obviously a worldwide controversy. There's been discussions previously about, you know, the health risks of meat, but this really sort of focuses on how dangerous it is.
And
obviously we've had discussions for years about the carbon emissions produced by processing meat and sort of the whole chain of command in terms of getting a burger on your plate, and how much CO2 is emitted during that, how much other greenhouse gases are emitted during that. So this also points to another risk of why meat is so dangerous.
So you're saying there's two strikes against meat, right? One, it will give you cancer potentially, and of course then all the news reports said, well, okay, if you eat, you know, 10,000 hot dogs a week, you better be careful, but the occasional trip to Fenway, since the hot dogs are so expensive there, you're not going to hurt yourself by eating them at Fenway, but you ought to cut out the meat, huh? And then the second strike is that it is, from a climate hawk's perspective, meat in general is a bad deal, right? From the carbon emissions perspective. Mm-hmm. And so you might ask yourself, why is that, right? Why is meat so bad? In fact, there's something I read somewhere that said that production of meat globally is equivalent in terms of carbon dioxide production to all the transportation in the United States, which is a huge amount of carbon pollution, right? I mean, if you could take every car off the road, you would think you'd made a dent. And so if you eliminate meat eating, you'd make a similar dent. But why meat eating is heavy on carbon dioxide? Because I guess the main thing is that all those cows and pigs and sheep and chicken, they all make methane. When they eat food, they basically pass gas, right? Mm-hmm. And that's I remember years ago, deniers making jokes saying, oh, global warming's due to all the cows in New Zealand, all the sheep in New Zealand passing gas. And there's some truth to that. We have these masses of animals that are basically in confined feeding operations, eating grain and passing all this gas. Then secondly, there's the argument that says to make a pound of meat, you need something like 7 or 8 pounds of grain. Mm-hmm. So now to make the meat, you have to then talk about agriculture. And, of course, that agriculture requires huge amounts of fossil fuels to run. In fact, the pesticides are there's production of carbon dioxide in the pesticides, in driving the tractors, in transport. So there's a huge amount there, and it really does start to add up. You know, the transport of meat, the refrigeration of meat, the processing of meat, it's a big hit. So, despite what some may say, it is in fact an enormous carbon dioxide production generating, right?
And this has led to the conspiracy theory that the World Health Organization is doing this as part of some sort of backdoor effort to sort of help the Paris climate talks. In fact, the former White House spokesman during the Bush administration, Dana Perino, and Rush Limbaugh both put forward the notion that this is the World Health Organization working with the UN to try to reduce meat consumption as part of a way to reduce overall greenhouse gas emissions, as part of a way to sort of help the advance the goals of the Paris climate talks. It's the weirdest conspiracy theory in the world, even for people who sort of live in a world of conspiracy theories, but that's what's being put out there, and I'm sure it's going to be repeated and recycled throughout the various the deniosphere. But I do have to admit, you know, with all this talk of the risks of meat, I'm surprised no one brought up one of the great cultural criticisms of meat, one of the great pop cultural references from the movie Pulp Fiction, where John Travolta asks Samuel Jackson if he eats bacon. Samuel Jackson says no, and when John Travolta asks him why, Samuel Jackson goes, "I just don't dig on swine, that's all."
Well, you know, I think that there's this some of the commentary I've seen about the carbon impact of meat suggests that people are very leery of advising people what to eat. It is scary, right? To say, well, you shouldn't eat meat anymore, da 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 da. I think for my money, it comes this kind of thing is such a diffuse issue. This is where something like a carbon tax really goes to work, right? Because a car if meat is that carbon intensive, you're going to pay more for it, right? And if that's the case, you know, so be it, right? That's the way the market, the magic of the market would adjudicate the whole thing. And I mean, everyone loves their meat, but you don't need meat to live, right? There's a certain amount of meat that you can live without. So anyway, DR, there's the meat story. We got into the heart of the matter, I suppose we should say, on
We
this
got into
one,
the meat of it.
the meat of it. But you know, the other thing I was thinking is that, you know, on this show we go from topic to topic, and we're typically driven by what the news of the week is and what's the top level news is typically the most interesting and what people want to hear about. But there are these ongoing issues, so I thought that we would take a minute and kind of race through five or six things that are real and are happening, and the climate hawks probably want to know, you know, what's going on in the background. So the first one of our little list here is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we have talked about a lot. Tell me, DR, do you know? I think I know, but what happened lately with the TPP?
What was reported the New
Or
York
didn't
Times
happen, as the case may be, DR.
exactly it was reported in the New York Times the President Joko Widodo, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing his name, of Indonesia, said that Indonesia will join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The New York Times piece goes on to discuss how Indonesia and the United States have a mutual interest in combating climate change, which makes it odd that both countries are so gung-ho about the TPP, because in an appearance on Democracy Now! On October 27th, the progressive economist Joseph Stiglitz brought up again the fact that in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the in investor state dispute settlement is still a part of that deal. And as he notes, the inspector state dispute settlement is fertile ground for fossil fuel companies to go to a country and say, "Hey, you have a law that's cutting into our profits. We're going to sue you if you don't get rid of that law." And how this deal could potentially sabotage, you know, whatever comes out of Paris could sabotage whatever is done in the United States to reduce carbon pollution, and is just a bad, bad,
Bad.
bad deal from a climate perspective, which again ties right back to the strange oddity of Obama and the president of Indonesia saying we're going to do something on climate, all the while cheerleading this deal.
Right. So the TPP is now in some sort of quiet period, right? There's like 60 or 80 days before it can be publicly released. Again, a delay. But it's these things are happening, but the TPP text hasn't come out, and we will update you when we hear about it. So the next thing on the list is President Obama's Clean Power Plan. And so what happened this past week, after much, 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 much talk, not just from you and I, DR, but from a lot of people, The president's clean power plan was finally officially published in the Federal Register, so it is now an official regulation that the EPA has put out, and people have to begin to enforce it. But of course, within hours of it being published, I think it was last Friday morning, 25 states' attorney general had rushed into court to try and stop it, right?
Exactly. There is a Megan Herzog of the Legal Planet site, a Legal Planet blog, talked about this sort of onslaught of legislation trying to stop it, and how that legislation is going to take a couple of years to work its way through the courts. It may not end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court until probably 2017 or 2018. So it'll be interesting to see how things go. It was reported on the 29th that the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where these lawsuits are, these lawsuits have been consolidated and will all head to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. They issued an order basically saying that there's not going to be any kind of hearing until, I believe, December the 23rd. So, in other words, after the Paris talks have presumably concluded. So this is going to drag out throughout 2016 into 2017, possibly into 2018, and then find its way up to the Supreme Court. And it's also been noted by Megan Herzog that there are other, that there's some other attorneys general, including the Attorney General of Massachusetts, trying to intervene in this, in these lawsuits on behalf of the EPA in support of the Clean Power Plan. California Governor Jerry Brown is very vociferous about saying that he will do whatever it takes to try to stop this effort to try to kill the Clean Power Plan. So it's nice to see that, you know, the forces of light are fighting the forces of darkness, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, just in closing, I think that the big threat right now to the Clean Power Plan is that some judge will issue an injunction, which means that some judge believes the state attorney general might win, and they have enough chance of winning that they should stop the implementation for 3 or 4 or 5 years while they argue it out. I hope that doesn't happen. The other interesting thing that people should know is that in the Senate, they're trying to pass a bill that would change the Clean Air Act in such a way that the justification for the Clean Power Plan would go away, which is scary. But of course, Obama will veto that if it comes to his desk. And finally, we won't go into any details, but there was some shaking amongst Northeast Republican senators who began to voice some support for the Clean Power Plan because of, I would say, grassroots pressure. So that's good. So, okay, there's the Clean Power Plan. DR, the next thing is COP21. We keep talking about this thing in Paris. COP21 is the Conference of the Parties. It's the 21st Conference of the Parties. This is a big, massive meeting in Paris where we hope they will negotiate what amounts to a global treaty to address climate change, right?
That's correct. And it also came out that I believe that Cristina Figueres of the UN indicated that there will probably not be a carbon pricing deal as part of this plan because of the difficulty it would be in trying to synthesize all the countries involved in trying to go for a carbon pricing plan. Essentially, there will be essentially projections. The idea is that the deal will involve projections or commitments on what to do, but it won't specifically, it won't specifically call for international carbon pricing or try to implement international carbon pricing. Right. That's something that each individual country will have to do on its own. But obviously, the goal, the long-term goal, and the only way to sort of achieve lasting binding emissions cuts is through some sort of international carbon pricing regime. So we'll see how that goes.
And I think that much of the talk that I've seen, and I think it's much more realistic than the idea that there's going to be one massive treaty that now and forever solves the issue. The treaty, it will be called a success if it puts us on a path and requires frequent amendment to the treaty itself. In other words, it steers us onto a path. We're all agreed this is going to be a 100-year operation, right? It's going to take decades. And so this one treaty just aims us in the right direction, gives us a groundwork for those subsequent discussions. And I guess the next thing is to aim for, coming out of Paris, they'll be talking about the year 2030 target emissions reductions, right? And we'll be gearing ourselves up to do those kinds of things. So DR,
this deal is a floor, not a ceiling.
It's a floor, not a ceiling. So DR, you and I are going to be back to COP21 because it's only going to become more important until we have a frenzy of reporting on it in December. But everyone who's listening should know that this is coming down the pike. So we get two more issues, DR. Right here in Massachusetts, we have talked at some length about solar, about caps, net metering caps on solar power. That is to say, legal limits on how many solar panels can be installed and still get this payback from having installed the solar panel. So it's called net metering. Many people have heard of it. I heard that the leader of the House of Representatives is going to carve out a separate bill to try and raise those caps because he knows the time is short, the need is high, and he's got to act sometime in the month of November, right?
Exactly. House Speaker Bob DeLeo indicated that he's looking for essentially individual legislation that will sort of raise the solar caps. Of course, as we noted before, there's no real reason to have any caps at all. We need as much solar as possible in this state. And to that end, there was a group letter that was sent to DeLeo and I believe Senate President Stanley Rosenberg and also Governor Baker by a collection of academics, community groups, and religious leaders, basically calling for a lifting of the net metering cap and pointing to the urgent need to have as much solar energy as possible, especially in light of the news from about the Pilgrim power plant going offline by 2019.
Oh, and that's a nice segue. So Pilgrim is sailing off into the sunset, right? It's going into the it's going to get on the boat with Frodo and sail away into the mist. There's a couple of things there. One is that the governor is talking about replacing that power from the Pilgrim nuclear station with hydro power, presumably from Quebec. And the governor got a big hug from a guy named John Dean, right, Dan? Tell me what happened there.
Yes, the former Vermont governor Howard Dean, basically endorsed Governor Baker's efforts to sort to have more hydropower brought into the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Dean noted that he had to deal with this issue himself when Vermont started moving away from nuclear power. In the Springfield Republican article about this meeting between Howard Dean and Charlie Baker and this sort of endorsement of hydropower, Dean made an unfortunate remark in which he suggested that solar and wind were, quote, not baseload power, as he puts it, which is a euphemismous way of saying that the wind doesn't blow all the time, the sun doesn't shine all the time, and it's intermittent. And the fact that he uses a climate denial talking point is very unfortunate for a guy who supposedly, this is a guy from Vermont, this is a guy from Bill McKibben's home state. You'd figure if anybody would get it, it would be him, and right. He just totally sort of drops the ball with this bizarre language about not being baseload power. Just an unfortunate remark.
It's propagating that meme that somehow renewables are boutique power that can't really handle, which of course the whole crux of the issue is making a way to turn solar power into a bulk provider. But I guess the other interesting thing on the Pilgrim power plant is that Cape Wind seems to be coming back. There was an article that said Jim Gordon, who is the guy who has fought for years to make the Cape Wind turbine project off Cape Cod, all of a sudden that's looking more attractive because the price is not that much different from what everyone's going to pay Hydro-Quebec. So why don't we do it, right? And it's an easy way out.
Exactly, that for all the people who thought that Cape Wind was dead, it looks like Cape Wind may just come back to life because you're going to have some reliable, contrary to what Howard Dean is implying, reliable power source to make up for the departure of Pilgrim Nuclear. And what more reliable source is there than offshore wind? So it looks like, for all these groups and all these billionaires and all these sort of quote-unquote activists who are trying to kill off Cape Wind, it looks like their dream might not be achieved, and that for no other reason than necessity, right, Cape Wind will be brought back to life. So again, it just shows you that Never give up, as the old saying goes. Never say die. Never quit. Never throw in the towel. That, you know, you can't kill someone who refuses to die, as the old saying goes. And this is an example of that. Jim Gordon may be remembered as sort of just an unbreakable man, an invincible man. That all the money in the world, all the efforts to try to take him down. All of it looks like it's about to fail miserably. Well, he emerges victorious. It's like the
I hope he's got a little ways to go.
He's gone 15 rounds and he's about to score the knockout. Basically,
we can only hope. We can only hope, DR. So that's the rundown of the background news for this week. I mean, there's so much that we can barely keep up with it from week to week. Mm-hmm. But I did want to touch base on those topics. So I hope that that sets everybody straight. So we'll try and put up links to most of the stuff. We covered a lot of ground, but most of the stuff that we talked about on the blog is massclimateaction.net/blog. When you're there, please donate to MCAN. We are pushing for those solar caps to be lifted. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can share us with your friends. You can listen to us on Stitcher, on TuneIn Radio, on iTunes. We're all over the place. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.